Chapter 16, Bombardment. One of the strange things about war is the way it brings people together. Before we left Guadalcanal, it reunited me with one of my buddies from basic training. I was standing by the water, looking out at the President Adams, the transport ship that would soon carry us to Bougainville. All of a sudden, a familiar voice drawled up from behind me. "Chief, that you?" I turned to look at the tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Marine beaming down on me. "Georgia boy," I exclaimed, holding out my hand. Instead of shaking it, he picked me up in a bear hug. "I'm so dang glad to see you," he said. "I'm gonna be with you on this here cartwheel, and I won't let nothing happen to my little Indian buddy." "Aside from the four ribs you just broke," I said, when he finally put me down and I was able to get my breath back. But I smiled as I said it. We Navajos know it's always good to see a friend, and it's even better when you know that a friend is going to be by your side in battle. "What was that cartwheel Georgia boy mentioned?" "Operation Cartwheel. That's the name they gave the Allied plan of which our invasion of Bougainville was a part. It was a good name, for our aim was to turn things around. If we succeeded, the Allies would no longer be on the defensive. We would be on the attack. West of Bougainville were the islands of the Bismarck Archipelago and New Guinea. All of those were in Japanese hands. The biggest and most dangerous Japanese airbase was at Rabaul, on the northwest tip of New Britain Island. Every day, Zeke's and Val's, Kate's and Betty's, came streaming out of Rabaul to make life hard for our forces. Yes, grandchildren, I'm sure that you now want to know what Zeke's and Val's and Kate's and Betty's were. Well, just as we code talkers made up names for things, so too did the ordinary fighting men create nicknames for just about everything. They did so for the equipment we used, like the name Alligator, given to our landing boats, and they did so for Japanese planes. Men's names were given to fighters, and women's to bombers. Zeke's were Zeros, fast little A-6M Japanese fighter planes. They could go 700 miles at 350 miles an hour without refueling, and climb up to 4 miles high in 7 minutes. They had two machine guns in the nose, two wing-mounted cannons, and each plane carried a 500-pound bomb. Until our carriers got the new Grumman Hellcats in 1943, nothing in the sky could outfly a Zero. Val was one of the enemy's big, slow two-engine bombers. Kate was the Japanese torpedo bomber, and Betty was their newer, faster Mitsubishi G4M, a twin-engined, long-range bomber. Why did we make up nicknames? Maybe they were easier to remember. Maybe, too, they just made frightening things more familiar, even a little funny in the midst of the seriousness of war. Personalizing a submarine that shells your beach every morning by calling it Oscar, or referring to that one sputtering bomber that flew over Guadalcanal as Washing Machine Charlie, made them seem less scary. A sense of humor can be just as important for a soldier's survival as a gun or a foxhole. D-Day for Bougainville was November 1st, 1943. 35,000 of the enemy were on the island, but Admiral Halsey and his staff had what they thought was a good plan. Aerial reconnaissance had revealed where the main concentrations of Japanese defenders seemed to be, in the southern part of the island. So the best place to attack was on the western shore, a place called Empress Augusta Bay, 40 miles from the nearest large Japanese base on Bougainville's other side. A patrol dropped by a submarine in September had scouted the area and found little evidence of defenses there, although they had also reported that the ground was very swampy as soon as he left the beach. There was a Japanese outpost at Cap Torokina nearby, but our scouts thought it had only about 100 men. Because the terrain was so difficult, with hills and mountains, jungle and swamp, it would be hard for the Japanese to get reinforcements quickly. We could establish a defensible perimeter, build a new airfield, then gradually work our way out to neutralize the whole island. While we were taking Bougainville, General MacArthur's forces would be landing on the western end of New Britain Island at Cape Gloucester to establish a new airfield there too. Planes from the two new fields would have Rabaul caught in between them. MacArthur had wanted to attack Rabaul straight on, but it was heavily defended. Admiral Halsey thought that too many of our boys would die on the beaches. This was before our forces landed on such awful places as Tarawa and Peleliu, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. Our leaders were still innocent about how many American lives it would cost to defeat the determined Japanese. However, as usual, just as soon as that plan was made, problems began to develop. Admiral Nimitz and the Navy were getting ready for the first attack on the Gilbert Islands, about 2,000 miles northeast of the Solomons. Nimitz demanded some of the battleships and destroyers originally given to Admiral Halsey for our Marines. So instead of two carrier groups, Halsey now had only one. There was plenty of grumbling in the staff conferences at Guadalcanal about Operation Cartwheel being turned into Operation Shoestring Number 2. We Marines usually felt resentful toward the Navy, and with good reason. When the first Marines were dropped on Guadalcanal back in August of 1942, the naval commander had been Rear Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner. In one of the dumbest moves of the war, he'd failed to prepare for a Japanese naval attack. The result was what we Marines called the Battle of the Four Sitting Ducks. On the night of August 8th and 9th, a Japanese task force came tearing down the slot, which was what we call that stretch of ocean between the Solomon Islands and New Britain, where the Japanese base at Rabaul was still in operation. They sank four American cruisers. Our whole fire support group was wiped out. Turner was forced to sail away with his supply ships only half unloaded. That left the Marines on Guadalcanal without any naval support, only half of their supplies, and 50,000 Japanese ready to wipe them out. So with half the spokes knocked out of Operation Cartwheel, lots of Marines were just saying, "Here we go again." Few of us slept the night before D-Day. We waited on board our ship for the first light of morning to show us the island. I kept checking my watch, uncertain if I wanted its sluggish hands to move faster or just stay still forever. Finally, it was 05:30, 5:30 a.m. in civilian time. The President Adams was still a few miles out from land, following the battleships and minesweepers that went ahead of us to enter the bay. Our objective was Blue Beach 1, the landing zone closest to Cape Torokina. It was too dark for me to clearly see the other men around me. Moving through the night sea in enemy waters, our ships were always kept in blackout so they couldn't be seen by Japanese planes. You weren't allowed to light even a match. But I knew that darkness would soon be broken before the dawn. I strained my eyes toward the northeast as I stood by the rail. Other silent men stood watching beside me. We could hear the sound of whetstones being drawn along blades as some of the other Marines sitting on the decks behind us honed their already razor-sharp knives and bayonets. Other leathernecks were tying and retying their boots, checking and rechecking their packs, their guns, their ammunition. A few of us tried to carry on conversations, saying anything we could think of to keep ourselves calm. "What about them Yankees?" said someone with a southern accent. I knew it had to be Georgia Boy. He wasn't talking about Northerners. Even though he was from the Deep South, he loved the New York Yankees baseball team. "They cleaned up them Cardinals four games straight," Georgia Boy added. No one answered him. One Marine a few men down to my left was singing softly to himself the first lines of a song that had just come out the year before. It was very popular with us Marines. He had a good voice, but either didn't know the whole song or was so nervous he could only remember the first line. "Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition." I reached down to touch my buckskin pouch filled with corn pollen. I had prayed earlier that morning, but now I whispered the words again in our sacred language, asking the holy people for protection. "Get ready for the fireworks, Chief," said the dark shape of a tall Marine next to me. Suddenly, a brilliant starburst appeared straight ahead, followed by another, and another. 2 seconds later, the thunder of the cannons reached us. It was 0600. The destroyer Wadsworth had begun the shore bombardment right on schedule. Other bursts of light began to appear as the Terry and the Sigourney joined in. Each ship had its own fire support area. Their shelling was supposed to soften up the beaches, drive back the enemy, and destroy his positions. It had worked on Guadalcanal. The surprised Japanese there had retreated back from the beaches, and the first landings had gone almost unopposed. Now the last of our minesweeper destroyers, the Anthony, opened up. It was so much closer to us that the firing of its big guns outlined the whole ship. The thudding whaboom of its cannons made our own decks quiver. The Anthony's target was a small island called Puruwata. Our transports had to pass close by there. The Anthony's 5-inchers roared off 2-gun salvos, one after another, though no return fire answered. On and on the shelling went. The whole sea ahead of us was alive with fire and drifting smoke. It was impossible to hear anything other than the constant, deep, thudding booms of our naval bombardment. It was pounding like the giant heart of the war itself, or a great thunderstorm without an end. Bougainville was visible now in the hazy morning light. I saw explosions from shell strikes blossoming on its distant shore. I knew that men might be dying there, but what I saw at that moment didn't seem terrible. Those bursts of white fire from the guns, those red circles where shells landed, looked like exotic blossoms, flowers that bloomed, then faded in less than a heartbeat. The tall Marine standing next to me leaned his head close to mine. Although I could make out his features now by the light of the explosions, I had never seen him before. He had a little black mustache and thick dark eyebrows that met over his eyes, almost like there was a caterpillar crawling over his brow. His dark eyes gleamed, and there was an excited, wolfish grin on his face. I've never forgotten that face of his, even though I never saw him again. "They're giving it to him," he yelled in my ear. "Won't even be a worm left alive on that beach by the time we get there." I didn't yell anything back to him. Somehow, I knew his optimistic words weren't true. Our naval bombardment went on and on, but I could feel in my bones that there were still enemy soldiers alive on Blue Beach. They were dug deep into the ground in reinforced bunkers. They hadn't run away from their posts this time. Their hands were on their weapons. They were waiting to kill us.